On the Southern panel's argument today is State versus McCall. I'd like to introduce our colleague, Justice Christina Pickering, who's in the audience and has worked with Appellate Court Judge Bonnie Bullock to invite and have present members of the Boyd Law School to observe our arguments today. This one and the one that follows. And I'd like to welcome all of you. Justice Pickering, would you offer a general introduction to these students? Give us the courtesy of that.
We already had an informal welcome, and excuse me for turning my back on you.
That's all right.
Welcome to the courtroom. We have the appellant, we have the respondent. And we are really glad to have you. I was talking to my colleagues about this before. The first argument got underway today, and it said that it's the third annual but first actual experience of the Nevada Supreme Court Las Vegas being able to host the Michael Douglas Pre-Law Foundation group of students. And the fellowship program has grown. It is an immense success, and we are so glad that you are here and interested in pursuing a career in the law and seeing what the lawyers do, how the courts work. As I explained to you, you've not received any cross-examination today, except perhaps from your colleague, the partisanship of the lawyers. But you won't see any witness examination. The judges do get to ask questions of the lawyers, and the lawyers answer the judges' questions. But in the appellate court, they're running on a clock, and you'll see a 15-minute clock up here. The lawyers have 15 minutes per side, and so the process is really abbreviated. What could be a whole trial is shrunk down to 15 minutes per side to argue the legal error that the appellant requires reversal, and then for the responding side to say, no, I'm unfairly squaring the result. Oversimplified to be sure, but that's what you'll hear. And so I'd like to now turn it back over to my colleague, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Doug Herndon, and Justice Rudia Siegler. This is the Southern panel. There are seven of us on the Nevada Supreme Court. I'm one of them. I'm not on the Southern Nevada panel. We divide it into Northern and Southern. They sit in groups of three, which allows us to theoretically get twice as much work done. I don't know. Working status is building it. But with that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you, Justice Pickering, and thank you for taking the time to initiate the visit to the court of these students. I trust you find this courthouse to be an impressive structure and one that I think the citizens of the Las Vegas community can be very proud of. And it is very functional, too, I might add. We are honored to have you present here today. Justice Michael Douglas is one of the close friends and colleagues of the members of this court and is clearly a leader of the legal community in every sense of the word. And we're so proud that all of you could be part of the efforts that have been made to increase the diversity in our bar and to make opportunities available to those who might not otherwise have opportunities to go to law school. One of these days, you folks will be up here arguing where these lawyers are, and you'll have the discomfort of knowing that a justice like me will be asking you questions, or maybe like Justice Stiglitz. We've asked the lawyers to stay after this argument, and introduce themselves, talk a little bit about where they went to law school, and a little bit about their career. I don't know if you'd have an opportunity to look at the briefs in the case, so I'm going to add 2 minutes to each side's oral argument today, the first 2 minutes of which I ask that they devote to their perspective of the facts in the case, so you have some context surrounding what the legal arguments are about. I think the lawyers know that we're very familiar with, we as justices are very familiar with the facts of the case. We generally tell the lawyers, don't spend time or waste your time talking about the facts. We know what the facts are unless there's some dispute about the facts and the record. Talk about the law. When you're in front of this court, that's what the issues are. What's the legal question that's at issue that requires an appellate court to decide in this matter? But for your benefit, I'd like to have each side offer their perspective about the facts and what's at, what was heard by the trial court in this case. So, Mr. Beaumont, Mr. Sands, are you ready to go? Okay, all right, Mr. Beaumont, please proceed. Thank you for your surprise participation today. When you come to the Supreme Court, you're always going to get a surprise. But this is a pleasant one, wouldn't you agree?
I do, Your Honor.
You don't have any other choice. You have to.
I love mandatory surprises, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you for being here.
And, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 12 minutes for my initial argument and then reserve 3 for rebuttal.
Sure.
Regarding the facts of this case involves two co-defendants, Collette Wynn and Charles McCall. Collette Wynn was on probation at the time, and her probation officers received an anonymous tip, a letter from an anonymous source, indicating that Ms. Wynn was violating her probation in a number of different ways, that ex-felons were going and coming from the place that she resided. She resided at a residence owned by Charles McCall, who is an ex-felon. When officers received this tip, they arrested Ms. Wynn and took her into custody. Some officers went with her to the residence to determine whether these tips were true. One of the officers ahead of time to surveil the residence and determine whether there were any indicia of reliability in this note. Officer Crow was the P&P officer from parole and probation who arrived on the scene first. He determined that numerous indicia of reliability in the note were present. On the way to the house, Officer Conroy and Officer Wilson were with Ms. Wynn. They spoke with Ms. Wynn, notified them that there were other people present in the home. Once they were in the home, they conducted a protective sweep. During the protective sweep, there were multiple firearms, drugs, and forgery laboratory equipment found in the defendant McCall's room, in Ms. Wynn's room, and in common areas throughout the home. Eventually, Mr. McCall was taken into custody, Ms. Wynn was taken into custody, and the Financial Crimes Section of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department obtained a search warrant to search the rest of the residence and obtain all of the evidence there. Thank
you. You can go ahead with your argument at this time, Mr. Bowman.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
That's okay. You're good.
So we're here for two issues on appeal. One, that the district court erred by concluding that a protective sweep requires a prior arrest. And two, that the district court's factual finding that the officers had not articulated a reasonable suspicion of danger was clearly erroneous.
So for the benefit of the students here and the other members of the audience, what happened in the district court that brings you here? What did the district court do that brings the state of Nevada before the Supreme Court?
The defendant, Charles McCall, on behalf of Charles McCall, filed a motion to suppress the evidence that was gained as a result of the protective sweep.
Okay.
Could you all, and I apologize, Justice Hardesty said we know all the facts, and I apologize if I've missed it somewhere, but what was Ms. Wynn on probation for?
I do not recall. I remember that she was on felony probation. Best of my recollection, it had something to do with identity theft, but I may be wrong.
Okay, thank you.
So I'd like to talk about issue number two first, because the court's abuse of discretion dovetails and segues into why the state is asking this court to adopt the majority view regarding protective sweeps in the absence of arrests. The lower court applied the law in an incorrect way. Not that it completely misstated the law, but it functionally misstated the law. Under Maryland versus Bowie, the Supreme Court held that there must be articulable facts taken together with the rational inferences from those facts that would warrant a reasonably prudent officer in believing that an area to be swept harbored an individual posing a danger to those on the arrest scene. The lower court, however, used a very different legal standard. There was no issue of arrest because Ms. Wynn was already in custody of the Department of Parole and Probation, and the court found that the officers had not testified to a reasonable belief and that there was not reasonable and articulable facts in support of this protective sweep. Now, the abuse of discretion is here twofold. What the court's restating of the holding in Bowie does is create a focus on whether the court effectively is playing Monday morning quarterback as to the objective reason, as to the reasonable beliefs of the officers once the court knows all of the evidence after the fact. Bowie, however, is far more objective. It's whether there are reasonable facts presented to the court at the evidentiary hearing. And the state presented numerous facts at the evidentiary hearing. There were facts by Officer Conroy that Ms. Nguyen was intentionally misleading them as to the code on the door to get in the house, and that that was done to alert the other people in the house that officers were on the way. That testimony was presented. There was testimony in the form of physical evidence as to the note that was given to the parole officers that started this investigation in the first place. The note contained numerous indicia that not only criminal activity was present, but that she was violating her probation. And that was the reason that these probation officers wanted in the first place. Yeah. Not to investigate crime, but to investigate whether Ms. Nguyen was violating her probation.
You would agree, though, wouldn't you, that the relationship between the probation officers and Ms. Nguyen is a lot different than the relationship with Mr. McCall in the context of a protective sweep?
It is for a few different reasons. One, Ms. Nguyen is subject to the probationary search clause that she signed while she's on probation. So under that search clause, probation officers have the ability to search her room, common areas, and so on in pursuit of whether there are reasons that she's violating probation. Now, Mr. McCall is afforded a different standard of a subjective reasonability regarding his Fourth Amendment rights. Mr. McCall is a felon.
And what's at issue here, again, for the benefit of the students, is the state's case against McCall.
Yes.
Okay, so let's focus on McCall.
So when the officers entered the house, they were greeted immediately by Mr. McCall, by a person that Officer Conroy did not recognize and actually did not know the identity of, and a barking dog held by Mr. McCall. So the officers at that point testified at the evidentiary hearing that they were concerned for their safety, knowing that Mr. McCall was a felon, knowing that they were confronted by a barking dog, and having testified that there was an unknown man coming in and out of the house that was referenced in the evidentiary hearing as outdoor man. So at that point, the officers testified at the evidentiary hearing that they were concerned for their safety and that there was, upon the entry of the home, one person at least unaccounted for, which matched the...
But counsel, Ms. Nguyen had indicated she had two roommates.
Yes.
And that she rented from Mr. McCall, correct? Right. And there were two gentlemen when you came in, when the officers came in, correct?
No, that is not correct. Officer Crow came into the living room first, and his testimony was that he did not see the third person who lived there. And whether the third person who lived there was or was not Mr. McCall or who ended up being Mr. Santos is not relevant to whether the officers reasonably believed there was a danger.
Well, what do we do with Officer Conray's testimony that the probation officers conduct protective sweeps as a matter of course? They were going to do a protective sweep no matter what. And they came in with their guns drawn, as I understand.
And that goes to issue one. Mm-hmm. If I may finish with issue two, I will dovetail directly into that. So with issue two, as far as the abuse of discretion, the facts were presented. There were facts presented to indicate that there were numerous indicia that the officer's safety was at risk. The note, the interactions with Mr. McCall.
So, but Mr. McCall, just because Mr. McCall is an ex-felon doesn't mean he has any less Fourth Amendment rights on that day because he's an ex-felon, right? I mean, he's not on parole. He's not on probation. It's his home and his bedroom. He's not on any paper.
He is not on paper. Okay. But what he has done is that as an ex-felon, he has also invited Ms. Nguyen to live with him. And by inviting someone who is on probation into your home, numerous courts have held that that creates a reduced and diminished expectation of privacy. But here, what had happened was the officers had asked Mr. McCall, we need to conduct a protective sweep. And Mr. McCall answers, it's okay, I've been on parole, I know how this works. So he opens the door to his room. So now the officers are in a place where they have a lawful vantage point into the room. They ask him to move the dog into the bedroom, and for their own safety, including the dog or anyone else who might be hiding, they look inside the bedroom, they look inside the room, they look inside the closet, only for a protective sweep, only very briefly.
But counsel, what factors justified, if you take out Mr. McCall as a felon or an ex-felon, what factors justified them going into Mr. McCall's room? He was cooperative. They asked him to put his dog away. He went to put his dog away per their instructions. At that point, what specific articulable facts supported a protective sweep of that residence?
The fact that Officer Crow testified that on the entry into the home, there was an unaccounted for person. He testified that when he encountered Mr. McCall and went into the room, he had not seen the other roommate yet.
So there's disputing testimony, correct? I mean, some officers testified both gentlemen were in the living room. Some testified first Mr. McCall was out.
My recollection, Your Honor, was that on page 139, 140, and 142, did you see the fellow that you encountered outside the residence before you came in? Did you see the outdoor man inside the house prior to opening Mr. McCall's bedroom? I did not. So at that point, that is his articulable suspicion as to an unaccounted for person.
But why did he believe that person was dangerous?
Because it goes into the totality of the circumstances.
Okay.
What they're receiving from the get-go is notification that their supervised probationer is engaging in narcotics activity, that weapons might be found, that the anonymous source is scared for their safety, and they have to go into this house assuming that when the other indicia of reliability were found to be true outside of the home, they have to assume for their own safety that the rest of this note also could be true.
So as soon as they got an anonymous note, you think they can search the house?
And it's not searching, protective sweeping.
Okay, they can sweep the house before they walk in just by virtue of an anonymous note.
Not in all circumstances. In this specific circumstances, the totality shows that there were numerous separate indicia throughout the beginning to end. First the note, later Officer Crow verifying that there was a person coming and going from the house, as indicated in the note. Ms. Wynn's efforts.
So what about a person coming and going from the house led a reasonable officer to believe that they are dangerous?
Because of the accompanying note, as well as Ms. Wynn's directed misleading of Officer Conroy en route to the house. She deliberately gave them wrong key code access to the door to notify the other people that officers were coming.
Mr. Beaumont, could you clarify something for me from this argument?
Yes.
What evidence did the district court suppress that the state would not be able to use in its prosecution of Mr. McCall? Was it the items that they retrieved from McCall's bedroom or something else?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, all of the evidence in this case was suppressed because ultimately the financial crimes detectives from Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department got a search warrant based on the financial crimes that were found, the forgery lab evidence, the IDs in Ms. Wynn's personal bedroom, the temporary tags that were forged in Ms. Wynn's vehicle, evidence of criminal activity throughout the house, not just McCall's bedroom. So while we were there for suppression of the items that were found in the bedroom, the lower court suppressed all of the evidence that was gained by the search warrant. Noted or reasoning that it was fear of the poisonous tree. But the rest of that evidence would have been found one way or another through an independent discovery or through independent sources.
Well, so let me add one more question to this. We focused on questions involving the scope and the permissibility of a protective sweep.
Yes.
But you mentioned a moment ago that when McCall was confronted in the hallway and asked to put his dog in the bathroom, which he did, that he consented to the officers entering his bedroom. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That was my argument before the district court. The district court determined that him opening the door and saying that I'm a parolee and I know how this works did not constitute consent. However, my argument again is that regardless of what the officers did in the protective sweep in the room, that was consent express or implied to search the room. Mm-hmm. And that gave them the right to be in their room where they found the shotgun shells that they ultimately detained Mr. McCall for. As the officers testified, where there's smoke, there's fire, and where there's bullets, there's firearms. And as a felon, Mr. McCall, after being put into custody and read his Miranda rights, testified or he stated and confessed that there were multiple firearms.
So he didn't articulate consent. It was the act of opening the door and commenting, I know how this works.
Yes, his statement that he knows how these searches work because he's a parolee, he's familiar, and his opening of the door was an implied consent to search.
Is there anything else you'd like to cover before you sit down for rebuttal?
Only reserving the issue for issue number one, that we should adopt the majority view, which, Your Honors, I will get into on rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Sandman.
All right, everyone. Of course, our position is that the district court had ruled correctly with regards to my motion to suppress the evidence in this case. Our basis, of course, is based upon the idea that even though there was a person in the home that was under probation, the circumstances of the relationship between Ms. Nguyen and the rest of the residents in the home was one of being a renter or a person that was renting a room from the owner of the home, who was Charles McCall, and that the other individual in the home was also renting a room, and that person was Mr. Santos in this case.
Do you dispute the assertion by your opponent that your client effectively allowed them to come into the bedroom without objection?
I would have loved for there to have been video of this particular exchange, because my client's representations to me were specifically on the issue that there was not consent given.
Let's stick to the record. What does the record show?
Well, the record shows that the testimony of the officers is that there was some type of movement that they believed allowed them to go into the room. But even if that was the case, the argument could be made that my client gave a very limited permission to go into the room only for the protective sweep and for no other reason. Mm-hmm. And here's the issue. I think locating shotgun shells in a room is not illegal. And that's the other part of the basis here to the argument by the state. And that is,
But if you're conceding that there was impliedly consent to enter the room for a protective sweep, anything in plain view can constitute probable cause of certain things, particularly if the gentleman's an ex-felon, isn't allowed to possess firearms, and there's ammunition.
Well, I don't know for sure if ammunition is part of the equation, though, with regards to an ex-felon. I think that's part of the argument here. If this was a federal case, absolutely, 100%. Ammunition by an ex-felon would be an issue.
But I mean, if they're in there with his consent, let's say impliedly, and see ammunition knowing he's an ex-felon, and then they ask him, which is what I understood occurred, are there any weapons? And he says, yeah, I screwed up. I've got a few weapons in here.
Right. And I think just entertaining Justice Hardesty's question in the beginning, the argument is, of course, is that our position is that consent was not given with that understanding at all. In fact, if anything, the testimony
I want to go back to the record and what the district court focused on.
Sure.
Officer Conroy testified that he did not ask McCall for consent. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
The testimony, as I understood it, was that they asked him to put the dog in the bathroom, that the officers testified that they saw both McCall and Santos in the front room when they came in. There was that testimony, but McCall had his dog. Is that correct?
That is the testimony from the officer.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the officers asked him to put the dog to secure the dog. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And he followed their instructions. And when he went into the bedroom to put the dog away in the bathroom, they followed him into his bedroom. Is that correct? And that is how they ended up in Mr. McCall's bedroom. Is that correct?
Yes, because the door was ajar. And then at that point, they were able to break the plane, I think is what the phrase was that was used.
And Mr. McCall's bedroom is separate and apart from both Ms. Nguyen's and Mr. Santos's bedrooms, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Just want to clarify a few facts.
And just with regards to the layout of the house as well, Your Honor, is that each bedroom had its own lock that did not allow for anyone else in the home to be able to access another person's room.
Sorry,
that was me.
And when the officers entered the home, their guns drawn. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So how did the court, counsel suggesting that the court erred in finding that this was not sufficient to support a protective sweep under Bowie, and if you would address Hayes as well.
Sure. With regards to Hayes in this matter, if I could just turn to my notes here on Hayes. The issue here with regards to Hayes goes under the issue of whether or not there was an emergency. In this particular regard, there was no emergency. Obviously, I belied by the record, probation believed that they had a reason to go into the home specifically to look into Ms. Wynn's part of the residence. They had secured surveillance beforehand. The testimony was that there was an individual that had gone in and come out. And then at some point, they approached the door. And when they approached the door, at that particular point, they decided, hey, we're going to go into the home. There's nothing in the record that indicates that there was any type of accident or emergency that said, we are going to take the next step in this case and actually search the entire home for something. If there was some problem with Mr. McCall, if he had not allowed them to at least come in through the front door, for instance, or not put up his dog, or fought with the police.